Freddie Cotton, August for being here, and thank you to the members who have come. I know that there are quite a few activities, and usually we don't put on a project, and I'm very grateful that you've arranged your diary session with me today. A very warm welcome to all of our guests, people who are representing organizations, schools, and in some instances, well, not today, but in some instances, staff and who are just stakeholders, interested stakeholders, for the education system. Warm welcome to the professor again. Nice to see you here. Hope that next week you'll be joining us as well as the may I just explain, this is the final meeting we're having. Mr. Rebecca, welcome. I thought you were in Durban. Is it tomorrow? Okay, well, welcome. And Rebecca from the Department of Basic Education. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here. Today is the final session that we have dealing with our oral phase of the public hearing. For those of you who are new to Parliament and who are new to the process, just so that you understand how we need to unravel this process, you would recall and you would have responded to an advertisement that we did place in national newspapers and various stakeholders to be conveyed to other stakeholders on our behalf, calling for submission on basically two issues. The issue was about access to education, the quality of education, particularly in schools. We received just under 300 registered submissions. Clearly, we were not able to call everybody to Parliament to engage with them on their submissions. What we did do was we went through all of the submissions together with staff researchers, Martin DeKaiser, Mr. Bundy, Mr. Mahada, and myself, and we picked out those submissions that we felt needed airing, that were raising something different. And there was a deliberate bias on our part to try and ensure that as many practitioners, teachers, and principals actually were able to come and address us on their concerns and their recommendations. Hence, we started our oral phase of the public hearings about 2 months ago, when we had our first phase, and after the World Cup, we embarked on the second phase. And today is our last session seeing stakeholders. We will then next week be going through all of the written submissions, summarizing the main points, trying to establish which are the areas of concern that are most common, and out of that process, we will facilitate and develop a report, which we hope to pass in the committee. As you know, we are a multi-party committee, so hopefully we can all agree on the report. And once we agree on the report, we will then be tabling it to the National Assembly with recommendations. If the National Assembly approves the report, those recommendations get conveyed on behalf of Parliament. As you know, we have a separation of powers. Parliament is different from the executive. We oversee the Department of Education. So Parliament will then, the Speaker's office will be sending those recommendations to the Department of Education and asking for a response and an action plan, basically, to implement those recommendations. We will as well be calling them to account on some of those recommendations in due course as well. So that's basically the process. That is, if all goes well. As you can imagine, that process will probably take quite a while still. We're basically just at the first phase, really, of our public hearings. And given that there are so many written submissions, I expect that we are a bit ambitious if we hope to finish next week just going through some of the submissions. What I have done is I've asked Mr. Bundy and Mr. Mahada to start going through the submissions and in tabular form pick out some of the main and essential points being made. Now, that's not always easy, but they have embarked on that already, and hopefully that will facilitate our discussions next week. So there you have it in a nutshell. Let me then just say finally that what we do have, though, is a department who's very keen to hear from stakeholders such as yourself. And because the process does take so long and could probably be finalized only at the end of the year and so on, the department has taken the initiative to have Ms. Chubeka and others here from time to time keeping a watching brief over proceedings here, so that if they come across certain issues, certain recommendations already now, that they can feed back into the departmental review processes. You would know that we recently had the curriculum review. They're able to pick up issues immediately and run with them through the department. So not really waiting for a report to emanate, recommendations, and then the processes of Parliament to take place. So that has been a real boost to our hearings and has really given us a great deal of impetus. And I do want to extend our thanks to these very, very busy people who have spent many hours just listening to the presentations made in the committee. So thank you again, and hopefully we will hear from you in due course, Ms. Chubeka, about your plans of action in regard to the hearings as well. On that note, let me immediately turn to the first presentation. Is it Ms. Haxson from the Faithway Christian School? I will ask Ms. Haxson, are you going to use the overhead projector at all?
Yes, we've got a DVD that's going to be playing.
Okay. Have you got your laptop
set up?
Oh, yes. Okay, great.
We're ready for it.
Wonderful. Please, 10 minutes for presentation, and then members will be given an opportunity to interact with you on any issues they need clarity on and so on. But over to you.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say what an amazing honor it is that I was asked to put on the presentation here. And in order for you to realize why it's such an exciting thing to have been asked to speak here, you need to get some sort of context of our school. And so I've got a short video that will be running in the background to just show you where we are coming from. And I think that it actually explains what I'm doing here today, because our school is a deeply, deeply, deeply rural school and an incredibly poor school in the middle of nowhere. And you'll be able to see our buildings and our facilities, which are incredibly rudimentary. And I think that that's actually why I'm here today, because our school faces some of the problems that are really besetting a great deal of schools in South Africa. Our district, the Sasonke district, has actually got the highest AIDS rate in the entire country. We are in KZN. We are up right close to the Lesotho border. And we've got a huge AIDS problem. Most of our learners are actually AIDS orphans. Our pass rate for matric last year, not the school's pass rate, but the district pass rate, Sasonke had the worst matric pass rate in the whole of KZN. So we're coming from a deeply problematic area where there is very, very poor, unsophisticated learners dealing with incredible problems. They can't get help with their homework because most of the households are children-led homes. There's no one to help them. Their houses don't have electricity, running water, or anything. And yet, despite this, for 12 years, our tiny school has had 100% matric pass rate. and we have been the top-performing school in our district for almost as many years. So we have managed to surmount all the problems that learners are facing in our country. One of the examples of our achievements is our head boy last year, a wonderful young man, Ndeni Nzamandi. Ndeni's father was the Induna on a cattle ranch. The reason why I say ranch is he died, and Ndeni was left head of the house at the age of 16 years old. He came to our school Faceway in grade 8. He could barely speak a word of English. At the end of grade 12, Ndeni matriculated with full exemption, and he was one of five people in the whole of KZN to actually gain a scholarship into the Spar Academy. This is the kind of achievement we're talking about. Ndeni had 17 siblings. His father had five wives. We are talking about really simple, rural people with few opportunities, and we are managing to give them a chance. Every single year, our 100% pass rate, most of the children move on to tertiary institutions and successfully complete university degrees. And I am incredibly proud of that. And basically, if we can do it, other people can also do it. And I think that that is why we were asked to share some of our ideas on education. And I know that one of our biggest problems at Faceway is the same as most of the country, and that's a matter of finances. We are a private school, which means that we rely for funding on school fees, and our parents are poor. And poor parents can't afford high fees, so our fees are very, very low, and even then, many parents do not pay. We don't have any big donors. There's no overseas organizations. We survive from hand to mouth on school fees. And we also, because of that, the teachers are almost volunteers. All the teachers, regardless, from the headmistress down to any other member of staff, whether they've got 1 year experience or 30 years experience, we all earn the exact same salary. And it is actually currently lower than our local municipal cleaners are earning, despite the fact that they're striking. So we know all of the problems. We have no real playing fields. We have no science labs. We need computers. There are no mod cons. There's nothing fancy at all in our school. But as I say, there is no doom and gloom. We are really, really achieving against all of the odds, and we've put together a submission on what we're doing and how we believe the curriculum needs to help the learners. If we start with our foundation phase, generally the feeling is in a foundation phase, you have to honor that word foundation. The foundation has to be deep. Foundations don't have to be wide, but they do have to be deep and strong. And the foundation phase really, really has to concentrate on cementing the basic skills. And the problems that we have with the current foundation phase syllabus is very often it is too broad and too shallow. The children are expected to master a wide range of skills, but they never actually master any of them in enough depth and detail. When you look at the foundation phase textbooks that are available, most of the textbooks jump around very, very quickly from concept to concept and topic to topic. And the children don't really get a chance to internalize the information and just absorb it in an organized, hierarchical manner. And so we just fear that the knowledge base is being broadened without leaving enough time to perfect, revise, and practice the basic skills of numeracy, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and the basic language skills. And language skills are an absolute key issue in our rural area, and I think in many rural areas, and I know it's a huge part of controversy in our country, the mother language versus dual medium versus the imposition of English. It is a very difficult issue. It's also an emotive issue. The problem is, our school, we run from the grade naught all the way through to matric. Many children enter our school at the grade 8 level, and we do find that those who have not had an early strong grounding in English are disadvantaged, unfortunately. And so we feel that the earlier children are introduced to English, the better they will be able to cope at a higher level, because the final matric exam is written in English. They are expected to read and comprehend the questions and then answer in a literate way. And it's devastating if children know the work but they can't express themselves in the language of instruction. And unfortunately as well, the tertiary institutions are wholly in English. And so even a child, if they gain their matric in another official language, it's wonderful, but will they not be disadvantaged at the stage of university? So it is a very, very tricky problem. And we feel that that the English does have to be introduced as a language of instruction from quite an early age. But at the same time, this means that the actual assessment standards in the lower grades have to be altered. Because if the learners are coming into an educational system where they're being educated in a language which is not their own, they are not going to progress at the same speed and level as children who are using it as a home language. And it is devastating to deny these children academic success on the basis of linguistic difficulties. So you have to be accommodating in the lower standards to move much more slowly, and definitely not nearly as broad, just to give the children a very, very, very strong foundation in the eventual language that they're going to be examined in. They deserve to be supported and assisted, and you've got to adjust your time allocations to the circumstances, giving them a chance to consolidate. Most of them are perfectly capable of meeting their ASs in due course, but they need to take smaller steps because they're mastering two skills, the new skill plus a new language, and that would enable them to experience success, and success, as we all know, is such a great motivator, and it'll help them to enjoy the whole learning experience. Teachers' files, I'm still dealing with the foundation phase, and the teachers' files and portfolios are still a nightmare. As a teacher, every time you open the paper, there's another promise that the files are being done away with, but it's actually window dressing. The administration is still huge. The amount of evidence teachers are expected to record. Obviously, you need accurate record keeping. There has to be continuous assessment. Marks have to be recorded. But detailed lesson plans, an experienced teacher does not need a detailed lesson plan. For a very experienced teacher, a lesson plan should be concise and above all flexible. You cannot plan out a whole year in advance. You can't even plan out a month in advance when dealing with young children. Because as you are assessing, you are realizing that certain concepts have not been grasped, and then they need to be re-taught, and that's going to mess up your entire teacher's plan. And then you can't stick to it anyway because you've had to adjust it. And it is completely unacceptable to push ahead because that's what your lesson plan says, if it's quite clear that the children need to go back and consolidate information after you have done your assessment. So you really can't move forward until you're happy that the base knowledge is secure. And the way of knowing whether the base knowledge is secure is there has to be regular testing to make sure the children have mastered the material. There should also be a test book. All the tests should be kept in the test book so that there is a continuous record of pupils' progress that can be referred back to. A great advantage that we have at our tiny school are the class sizes. Our classes are small, and we do find that this is to our advantage because we are able to help each child individually, and especially in the foundation phase, children need a lot of individual attention. The smaller the classes at the early phase, the better, in order to help the children fully master the skills. Managerial capacity at schools. It is also another problem across the board, we feel, in the country, is that many good teachers, because they are good teachers, end up getting promoted out of teaching. They move into the managerial position, and they are lost to the learners who could really benefit from their skills and from their experience. and yet the teachers attempted because of financial constraints. And perhaps the system could be worked out whereby the teachers could still be promoted, but in a two-tier system where you have people achieving a higher ranking and salary while still being available in the classroom and not just sitting in a managerial position. Our learners at our school, as previously mentioned, have tremendous social problems, and this is particularly evident in the foundation phase. When you come with children who have come from homes where they've been physically, emotionally abused, where they have suffered great loss, where they are in child-led households, they lack social skills. They do not know how to demonstrate appropriate behavior. They are completely undisciplined. And again, schools have to step in and provide love and security and attention and take over, unfortunately, a lot of the parental roles in teaching children these appropriate social skills and the things that parents used to do, because unfortunately there aren't enough parents available to do these tasks in many, many rural schools. The comment that we made for the foundation phase is that we attribute our success to a combination of discipline and caring. Homework has to be done. Uniform has to be correct. Routine is followed very, very rigidly. Bad behavior is not tolerated. No child may be absent without a written explanation. If there are any problems, social, academic, a caregiver is called in immediately. So the children can feel safe and secure while still having very rigid boundaries in the foundation phase. From grades 4 to 7, it's pretty much the same thing. All you're doing is, by grade 4, all subjects we feel should be taught using English as the medium of instruction, so that when the children do enter high school, they are completely competent in language. Homework has to be emphasized and given daily at this point, so the learners learn good study habits. We often tell our children, you cannot wake up one day and decide to run the comrades. You've got to start off walking around the block and then jogging and build up into the race. And the matric exam is the same thing. You can't suddenly try and master study skills in grade 12. The foundations and the discipline for good study skills have to begin in the intermediate phase, and these skills will carry over and be built upon. At the grade 4 to 7 level, reading has to be emphasized. The children have to be able to write book reviews and read regularly. They need a regular spelling schedule and spelling tests on a weekly basis, and marking, obviously, regular, thorough supervision, lots and lots of corrections, and constant remediation and reinforcement. My particular area of expertise is in the high school. I'm a high school educator, and I notice when the students do enter the high school that many of the problems and challenges from the primary phase are carried over to us, especially when we get children who come from other schools who have not been educated in our school. It becomes particularly evident where there have been holes and we have to block them. There's also been a difficulty as a high school teacher with the OBE system. Many learners, when they come into high school and throughout their high school careers, if they have been educated under the OBE system, they just are lacking a lot of the firm foundations of grammar and rules. Unfortunately, OBE did throw out the so-called rote learning, but there's some things that you just need to learn off by heart. You have to learn spellings and timetables and that by rote, so they are second nature to you. And where that has been neglected, the children really, really are disadvantaged. And another problem with OBE we found is the group learning. Group work is a wonderful concept, and it teaches a life skill, but we are dealing with young children. And what happens is whenever there is group work as a teacher, I find that there are the malingerers who ride on the back of the successful students, and your A student does all the work and then has to share the marks with your lazy child who only attended half the lessons and did none of the homework. not only does this frustrate the hard-working student, but it also means that when it comes to the exams, the malingerers or weak students come horribly unstuck because they never actually did the work, so they never internalized it and they're unable to use it. They just sat there while the others did the work, and you'll often notice a discrepancy between a class mark and an exam mark, which will be purely due to group work. So we think that we need to really, really return to basics and emphasize them so that the learners are not given a disservice. Another problem we found in the high school are the assessment standards. It feels as if they're quite erratic and as people are still trying to find their way. The leap in outcomes between grade 9 and grade 10 is massive. And we do know that grade 9 is an exit point, and so it has to be kept fairly simple. But the sudden jump to grade 10 is massive, and many learners battle with that transition. Also, the department said grade 9 papers have been quite disturbing because the level has been fluctuating and isn't really reflective of what has been asked for during the year. The outcomes for the grade 9 syllabus are fairly undemanding, but the end of the last year, the final papers for grade 9, would have challenged most of my matric learners. They were incredibly challenging, and the children were very, very demoralized. The vocabulary and the comprehensions and that, it was extremely sophisticated and well beyond a grade 9 learner, especially one who was writing first language despite actually having English not as their home language. Textbooks are a nightmare. They get changed frequently, and I think it's because there is indecision as to what the actual outcomes ought to be. But in a poor school, changing textbooks and changing the syllabus is a very, very big problem because the learners have to get new books. They can't pass them down. The school is unable to keep a stock of books to circulate. Every second year, we've got to get a complete new set of books because the previous ones are completely redundant. We get donations of books from the community, but what the community does is they donate us their second-hand redundant books, which are useless to us anyway because they don't fit in with the new syllabus requirements. So it would be really great as an educator if we could get to the point where we've decided exactly what the children need to be doing and carry on so that a child can pass their textbooks down to their siblings, to their friends. The cost of textbooks for learners is phenomenal, and it's really unfair at the start of a school year for a poor child to have to spend R1,000 on textbooks before they even start school, because the ones from the previous year were discontinued as not acceptable. And even with the current textbooks, we still have to supplement with photocopied notes, which is really pricey for a poor school. And we have to supplement for photocopied notes for the same reason as the foundation phase. Most of our textbooks are inadequate. Sadly, they introduce the concept in the most wonderful way, and then I will have one, maybe two exercises on that concept. It's not enough. A child, once they've been taught a concept, has to repeat it over and over and over again until they have fully mastered it and then move on. It's not enough to teach a concept, have one exercise, and then jump on to the next chapter. And unfortunately, that is the way most of the textbooks seem to be. They have a wonderful variety and scope, but they jump around too much, and it's impossible for a child to fully internalize on this basis. Back to the portfolios in the high school as well, we feel that the changes to the portfolios and the teacher files are really just window dressing, and they don't create less work. It was very exciting. We only have to have one file now for all the subjects taught, but we still have to have the exact same amount of information in that one file. So instead of several small orderly files, we now have one huge, chaotic, unwieldy file. And this is especially problematic if you teach several grades and several subjects. It's impossible to keep everything in an orderly fashion in one file. Most teachers have just carried on with their multiple files just because it's more coherent. Similarly, we've been told that the learners' portfolios have been scrapped. But that's also a matter of semantics because we still require the same amount of evidence of work from the learners, so it's just kept in a different place and not called a portfolio, but it's still the exact same work. The final thing is to say what the success of our school is right the way across the board. We feel that it's because the learners are taught all subjects in English. They've done all their education with us and have learned in English since grade one. So they can read and understand the exam papers. They can express themselves adequately. As I said before, it is terrible if a learner understands the subject but just does not have the language skills to express their knowledge in the final matric exam and ends up being disadvantaged. So, in our opinion, the importance of early instruction.
You've just gone beyond 10 minutes, and there's hardly any time left for questions. So, if I were you, I'd just quickly round up, please.
Okay. And I think the final thing that I would say is I would like the government to look at the gap that we have. There are government schools, and there are wealthy private schools, but there are a lot of small community-based private schools that are just falling through the cracks and who get very little support from anybody at all, and we're drowning. Maybe there could be a way to get co-opted and we can work together because we're doing a great, great job, but we do need some help. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and let me just immediately extend our congratulations to you and to your school. And please, won't you convey our best wishes to all of your staff who do a wonderful job under very trying circumstances. And one of the reasons why we called you particularly here today was not just that you've given a kind of a general input, but you do bring that perspective, a very rural, under-resourced school, and yet achieving quite high results, particularly if one were to just measure your matric results. So thank you very much for your input. Let me right away just check members. Questions? Mrs. Moshwana? Everybody? Okay, let's start from Mr. Ponchane down. Try and be very brief in your questions, knowing that we don't have too much of time. I don't want to take some time off the other people's presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. It sounds familiar. I come from a very deep rural area, and I did also teach in rural schools. But talking about OBE, what really, because your school seems to be achieving and teaching the same syllabus, I mean the OBE, you don't seem to have a problem with OBE as such. What is it that really makes you succeed in spite of?
I'll write them down. Okay. I have got one, thank you.
Thank you. A question, but I just feel I need to just express my appreciation. I'm not the chairperson. I know the appreciation will be expressed by the chairperson, but really, you know, I was absorbed in what you were doing here or explaining here. I learned one thing. You say foundation has to be deep and not wide. This is what I've learned from you, and I don't think I'll forget it, and I'll use it where I go. Thank you.
Also, thank you for your presentation. Just one comment. I think noting what you want from the department is that we should focus on the worst performing schools and leave the best performing schools to do their thing. And then two short questions. What exactly are the school fees and the ratio, the teacher-learner ratio at your school? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I still have that voice problem, but I'm sure, or rather challenge. Actually, I also want to add my voice. You are doing a wonderful job at this school. The name itself explains your faith way. But, you know, whenever I listen to you, I don't know whether I become discouraged or what. Because it's like you are telling a story which is very painful. And you are at a private school, which is a choice to be private. And because of that, you do have a reasonable teacher-pupil ratio, which in a public school, maybe they cannot do as best as you because of the large numbers. So that there are advantages and disadvantages to be in that position of yours. But you are also telling us about challenges. One of them, or a few of them, courses and workshops. You mentioned that the trainers are not necessarily people who teach. So they come with ideas which then they themselves cannot. It's like lectures are not involved in education. I guess you are talking of the curriculum advisors and stuff. And that you talk of the qualifiers, but qualifiers does not reflect the quality educators. I'm so confused. It's like I don't know whether to call it a mess of a situation. The question is, can you apply and become public? Can you afford to do that? Thank you.
My frustration now is that all my questions are partly raised, but perhaps there will be one that I may want to check with you on the language policy. Are you strictly saying you only take those that will be instructed in English? Or what is it that is happening there? The other for interest sake is that despite earning low wages, you think you haven't gone on strike. And there's no violation in terms of how workers or teachers are supposed to be paid in that particular school. The last one is that as you are looking for this kind of assistance, in terms of classrooms and everything else which happens to a public school, what then will be the difference between you and the public school? Because if government ends up supporting you, like not just subsidies that are somewhat given to private, but giving you literally almost everything that is given to a public school, will it be just a name in you being a private institution, or what exactly will be the difference? Thank you.
Okay, some very interesting questions. First of all, some brutal honesty on OBE, why we succeeded despite OBE. I think it's because to a large extent, when it comes to the rock face, teachers have often ignored OBE and done some of the concepts but still carried on making the children learn their times tables and spellings, even if it doesn't say so in the textbooks, because we know it works. So I'm sorry to be honest about that, but it's the reality. The school fees, teacher, learner ratio, et cetera, our learners, it depends on whether they're in grade 0 or matric, but the school fees range from just over 300 rand a month for the grade 0s up to, I'm not the grocer, but it's approximately 700 rand a month for a matriculant. And the ratio of teachers to learners depends completely. The smallest classes are sitting on about 7 learners, which is incredibly tiny, and the largest class is 25, that's our grade 8s. But I want to emphasize the reason why the classes are small are not because we want them to be small. It's just because we do not have the ability to take in any more learners. We don't have enough space. We do not have enough learners. We want to be bigger. We want to serve the community more. We just can't because we don't have enough toilets for them, nothing. We're kind of right at the limits of what we are able to provide, and we're wanting to provide what we can for so many more learners. And that goes on to what many of you people have asked, is about the private school, the difference between us being private and why we aren't government, etc. It isn't that we have a desperate desire to be a private school. It's that there isn't a government school. There was no school, so we built one. It's as simple as that. There are other schools in the area, yes, but they are all a Zulu-speaking medium. There is no English-speaking high school within 100 kilometers. So the government didn't provide us with a school, so we just had to build our own. It's not because we wanted to be a private school.
Any subsidy at all?
We do get a subsidy, but compared to the costs and the overheads, it's a drop in the bucket. But as I say, it's that we didn't have pretensions for any reason to be a private school. It was simply that in any direction in 100 kilometers, there is no English-speaking school. So there was a need, and we filled it. I wasn't too sure about the striking question and the violation of salaries. Basically, just the teachers who are at the school, we are dedicated educators. We're passionate about the learners. We're passionate about education. And so, I don't know, there just doesn't seem any point about arguing over salaries, because we know there is no money, and if there isn't any, we can't ask for any, and so there's no point. If we want to earn more money, I suppose we could become municipal workers, but we're not. We're educators, and we know the constraints our school is under. And so you can't ask for more money if you know for a fact there isn't any. And we know that the children need us. And we know that we're fulfilling something that is just so essential to our community. And so that is our reward, I suppose. Do we only take English-speaking students? Yes and no, as in the language of tuition is English, and that's the whole reason for our being. There are other schools in the district. If you wanted to be educated in Zulu, there are lots of Zulu schools. But we are the only one that offers an education in English. So the people choose to bring out their children to our school if they want their children to get an English medium education. Our eventual dream is to have a bridging class at some stage for the grade 8 and 9s, where we can take in children with very weak language skills and provide them a separate bridging year to get them to the level of competence that the learners who have been with us from grade 1 have achieved. And we'd like to do that, but again, we do not have the staff or the resources at this stage. The bottom line is that we really want to grow and share what we've got, but we just lack the resources to do it. And we don't really mind what route it is necessary to take. We're not partly private. We're just trying to educate the children. I don't know. Have I answered all the queries? I think I have. I said it depended. The class sizes, some are smaller, 7, some are 25. In the high school, we have 4 full-time teachers, and the junior school, we've got grade 1, 2. We've got 5 in the junior school. Classes have to double up. Our grade 4s and 5s have to have a combined lesson. The teacher teaches them both simultaneously.
And let me just assure you that your concerns with regard to curriculum and the lack of ability, really, of the curriculum to ensure that a solid foundation is laid and a space for repetition and so on is not just a concern that you've raised. It comes up over and over again from different practitioners who have written in and so on. So that is certainly a big issue that we will take up with the department as well. I think you might benefit before you go if you were to just speak to Ms. Chubeka over there before you, and I know you have to leave because you've got a flight, Ms. Chubeka. just on the issue of those files, because I know that there has been some, I know that I got a pamphlet that the department issued out to all schools. You may not have received it, just explaining some issues, you know, sort of common questions that teachers had and so on. Because I'm told that it's not just one file. If you wanted to, you could have different files. It's not the file that's, and I would have thought that the whole point of the review in terms of administrative work is to actually reduce that amount of chaos, as you called it. So please do, and maybe Ms. Chubek can just give you one of those circulars as well and so on, right? Thank you very, very much. And as I say, please convey our best wishes to the staff and students. And hopefully when we are on our provincial visits, this is one of the schools that we'll try and come and visit. We'll certainly keep in touch with you via Mr. Brown and let you know closer to the time when we do come out to KZN. We'll try and touch base. Let's move on to the next presentation, and we have Muirdale Primary School, Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for giving me this opportunity of coming to speak here this afternoon. Briefly, I started my school career up in Damaraland, that's the old Southwest Africa or Namibia, in a town called Korigas. It was a school called Cornelius Goresep. It was a high school as well as a teacher training college. So that's where I started my career. But for the rest, I have been at Muirdale Primary School. I was in the teacher's ranks for 18 years, worked my way up through head of department, deputy principal, and have been the principal of the school for the past 15 years now. I became principal at a time when a lot of my colleagues were taking the voluntary severance package, and I felt that it was a calling, it was a wonderful profession. I had to stay in teaching, and that is why I'm still in teaching, and that is why I'm still passionate about it, and possibly that's why you've even invited me here today. Maybe you've read something between the lines. I feel that there's still lots that I can offer to learners. I've been given various other job opportunities, I've been offered other opportunities, but I'm still in the school. I serve on the Heads Forum of the South. The school, Muirdale Primary School, is situated in the southern suburbs of Johannesburg. There's plus minus 35 schools there that I'm on the Heads Forum, and we work very strongly and jointly together because we think very similarly. The sad part about it is that we are split across two districts, and it's very difficult to keep the like-thinking schools thinking alike when we are working under two districts. But nevertheless, that's a challenge that I work on a daily basis. One of the issues that I'd like to point out from the start is that my school, Muirdale Primary School, was built for 650 learners. Currently, we are very close to 1,200 learners. So that is an incredible problem that we are facing, that the school is far too overpopulated. The sad part about it is that within a 2 and 3 kilometer radius of the school, we have schools that are standing empty, there are classrooms that are empty, and yet our schools are filling up, they're brimming from year to year. We are taking and sometimes forced to take more and more learners into the schools. It's affecting schools that are running well that we are actually now being pulled down to a certain extent. One of the sad parts about the last 15 years in education is that there have been so many changes. I wonder if there's anybody in the education department who has actually got a full picture as to where education is at the moment. I think heads of schools, principals are possibly in the best position to point out the effects and the results of some of the changes. And please don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that all the changes are negative, but there are just tremendous number of changes. Each subsection or department within education is so caught up in their own importance, and I'm not being derogatory or negative about this, I'm just saying, everybody sees their aspect as the most important part of education, that the whole global picture has become lost. I found it very difficult to even try and compartmentalize this chat today so that I could chat under a different heading so that people could understand where I was coming from, because things are so integrated and so linked. And I do hope I do not lose you along the way. Meadow Primary School was an ex-Model C school. When I started there, there were 200 learners, all white learners. I've seen the full transition. We have gone from a completely white school to what I would almost categorize now as a completely Zulu school. The white children left. The colored children have, to a certain extent, packed up and left. There are a few that are left there. One or two Indian children, and the rest are black children. And I would like to just mention that there's going to be a problem somewhere along the line. A language issue is going to come up again. It's something that we had 20, 30 years ago. Language became an issue. I can see language is going to be an issue. And I don't want to dwell on the language issue. I think that is a problem that we need to look at, and we need to foresee that it's going to become a problem. But it's very interesting to see the transition of this school of mine that is now almost become a totally Zulu school, but yet they still have to learn Afrikaans, and I can see repercussions of the past within the near future. But let's just get on to the aspect of the starting age of children. I think the policy was very well defined. Children had to turn 7 the year they started in grade 1. There was no problem. Everybody was happy with that. And then there was a court case that the state lost, and all of a sudden it was changed that now 6.5-year-old children could go to a school or starting grade 1. What worries me is the next time they lose a court case, are we now going to make it younger and younger and younger? Now, the situation arises that you have 5.5-year-olds starting in grade 1 that are in the same grade with children who are 8 years old if they are repeating. So there is a good 2.5 to 3 year difference in children when they start in grade 1. And I think that is astronomical at that very early age. I have the situation where I run a private grade R or grade naught attached to the school, and there the children have to be 6 to join into the grade R scenario. And because of the difference of the age difference of those children at such an early age, we actually put the children into 3-month categories. So in other words, the children that are born in January, February, and March are put in one class together. And the children who are born in April, May, and June are put into another class together, and so it goes on, the October, November, December children in another class. Because this, we find, stops a lot of bullying. There is such a tremendous difference between a child born, a 6-year-old child born in January, and a 6-year-old child born, or the child that's still going to turn 6 in December. So there's a big gap. And we need to look at that in the grade 1 scenario, where, as I say, you have a 7-year-old child that has to repeat, and you have a 5.5-year-old child coming in. So you've got 5.5-year-olds and 8-year-olds in the same grade that teachers have to contend with. And it is a problem. Then the problem that we contend with is the issue with feeder area and where the children come from. Children, as far as I understand or understood in the past, should be able to walk to school for a number of reasons. Yes, the safety, security reasons now of walking to school. But let's say the walking distance is within a radius of the school, whether they walk or whether they catch transport or whatever it is. But there has to be some sort of community feel about it. We're finding that more and more children are coming from further and further apart. I've had children at my school. I've had the prince of the Khoza people at the school. I've had the MEC of the Free State child was at the school. He left last year. He's gone to Grey College this year. We've had a number of children. I've even got the grandchildren of the mayor of Johannesburg, grandchildren coming from Kensington to my school on a daily basis. Now, we are losing...
Sorry, I have 2 minutes.
Sorry? We have lost the community feel of the school. Then we have policies that the school is allowed to draw up, but district's head office can override. Other policies I feel need to be given to schools. HIV, AIDS, for instance, codes of conduct, admission policies. Give those to the school so that we can free up the time of the staff to get back to the basics and work within the classrooms. Then another issue that's affecting schools is the protocol. Parents seem to have access to MECs, directors of education, whereas teachers and principals, we cannot get to these people. There needs to be a direct protocol where possibly parents do not take matters further than the IDSOs within a school the situation, and that issues are handled not higher than the IDSO, and that when there are issues that school have, that the IDSO can take those further. I'd like to see with the new dispensation coming in, I'd like to see a manual that all principals could refer to so that we don't have to have as many meetings that we have on a regular basis. Principals are called away, teachers are called away from class. We need to be in the classroom, we need to be in the schools, and if there is a question, we need to refer to a manual so that we can get the answer from the manual rather than traveling, fuel problems, etc., etc. In educators, we are told to keep our standards high, but no longer are we allowed to appoint the educators that we feel are capable of doing the job that we want them to do. And very often, it's not the best academic teacher the best academic that is the best teacher. It's sometimes a person who has struggled through their own schooling and who has gone through a college that makes a very good teacher. I'd just like to end off with a thought that came from one of my top teachers. She started teaching her studies in Mowbray College here in the Cape in 1966, where she initially only did 2 years of study. She did go on to study further, but the head of the college in 1966 said to this teacher, "There are only two things you need when you go out to teach. One is psychology to handle the learner and the parents, and the other is methodology." And I think sometimes we're missing the point now. We're putting far too much emphasis on academic level rather than the methodology. And unfortunately, I do have a number of other issues, but I would just like to conclude by saying I would like to see teaching becoming an essential service so that we can stop the strike action and all the other interference. We are professional people, and we need to be back in the classroom doing the work that we've been trained for. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. And with 15 minutes, so members, we have 15 minutes only to engage with the speaker. Mr. Murray, I take it that there are two, look at your submission, there are two big issues. The first is clearly the district support and the support that you clearly lack as far as your school is concerned from the district, and you point to various issues. The one is the kind of thing that you raise in your oral submission is things like handouts and so on, which you don't get policy documents, which you then ask to go to meetings and then people merely read it out to you. But secondly, you point out in your written submission that actually district officials overrule policy as you understand it and want to implement it, and they kind of go another route. Now, on that score, may I please invite you to give us some specific examples of that in writing. If you want, we won't disclose that we received it from you specifically, but we are an oversight committee as well. And one of the things we hope to do still this year, if not early next year, actually go out to the provinces and specifically look at district offices. We had Dr. Ismail here yesterday, also from Gauteng, but he operates in the West Rand. You, of course, Southern Joburg. Clearly two different experiences emanating. He seems to think that, you know, things are reasonably good in where he's situated. So clearly it's a local, more regional kind of dynamic that seems to pertain in this regard. And we would need more specifics attached to that general comment that you've made in your submission to really look at some detail into this problem. Members, Dr. Floppus Lawrence, good, that means more time for me.
Mr. Murray, I want to be quite frank about your one problem that you've mentioned, protocol and the problems with the districts, the appointments, interference with the appointments, the meetings. I call it the stranglehold of our hold of unions on education. I'm not going to name names. I visited quite a few schools in your area, south of Johannesburg. I was invited to a meeting of principals where some of the disillusioned district officials also attended this meeting. And I really want to tell the other colleagues of this committee, it is an absolute real problem in your district. I know. I was there. I saw. Two other questions. You referred to the age problem in grade one, and you mentioned bullying. Will you please embroider on that? I would like to know more about that. And then also your language policy. You said a Zulu or a Xhosa print and the MEC of the Free State, your language policy is Afrikaans language, is the language of tuition. Will you also explain to me exactly what's going on there? You've got an SGB. What is the language policy? Please, thank you.
Okay, I didn't really want to
not
touch.
Not yet, Mr. Murray.
Sorry.
Let me just elaborate on some of those questions. You raised the issue of inclusion in your written submission, which I haven't touched in your oral submission. And we have, I think, in this committee expressed a bit of concern about the concept of inclusive education in as much as policy seems fine. But the problem is with implementation and support that the schools get from the various provincial departments in the form of school psychologists, social workers, and other such necessary expertise to be able to deal with this. What is your experience as far as your school is concerned? I see you raised the issue of autism, being prevalent there, and that clearly you have a child who has the special and individual needs, and given the class size that you operate in, the teacher's unable to cope, and clearly there's no support there. But could you just elaborate, is there some support available to your school from the district or wherever, where you can make a call and say, look, you know, we need a social worker to come in on this day, whatever, to deal with X, Y, Z problem. Are you able to do that? The second thing that I wanted to just raise with you, you said there that you're not allowed to appoint the best teacher. Now, could you just clarify for me, what is the process? I understood that the interviews are actually done at the level of the school with the SGB and so on involved, and that you make a recommendation, I think three recommendations to one post or something of that sort, which then has to be confirmed and finalized by the province. Now, if that is incorrect, please just correct me and tell me what is the procedure that you use. And then lastly, you say that most of your school is composed of learners whose home language is Zulu, and yet you say they're forced to learn Afrikaans. Maybe you want to clarify and contextualize for us what that means?
Okay, Madam Chair, the issue with the language is not an issue at this stage. What I'm saying is it could become an issue where we have had parents. Well, let me go back. There was a stage where we were doing English as our language of learning and teaching, second language being Afrikaans, and we were offering Zulu as a third language. But then we had a lot of opposition. Parents wanted to know why we weren't offering Tswana and why we weren't offering Khoza and the other languages. So that became an issue. After discussion, we decided that we would stop the third language at this stage because there was such a need for English. The children are coming in not having English as their first language, so that was the emphasis would be placed on the English. But I've been chatting to other principals in the area. As I say, I'm part of the Heads Forum, and they actually raised the issue, and I'm sorry that I brought it up, but it's just fresh on the mind at this stage, and I don't have all the facts and figures. But they are saying that they foresee that there is going to be a problem coming up shortly, that Afrikaans is not going to be the language that they want to do as a second language. And the children are going up to high school, and they're not being offered or not given the opportunity of studying in a mother tongue at this stage. So I just see that there could be something growing for the future, that we need to look at the whole issue of language.
I understand what you're saying there, but what I'm trying to establish is you made the comment, and you said they still have to learn Afrikaans. I'm not sure at your school specifically.
At the moment, yes, we still...
As a second language.
As a second language.
And that you offer English medium and Afrikaans as a second language. You don't offer any other language.
No, not at this stage. I'm just saying that could become a problem because we need to find the teachers to accommodate the change that could be coming about. But it's not a problem at the moment, not at all. Yeah. Okay. No, that's fine. Getting back to the process of appointments of staff, you're quite correct. There are three recommendations, but governing bodies are feeling already their powers have been taken from them. Why can they not just make one recommendation and recommend the person that they want? There have been cases in the past where the three recommendations have not met with the approval of higher authorities, and certain schools have been asked to take certain people into certain positions, HOD positions.
Has that happened to your school?
It's not happened at my school, no.
Okay, well then don't speak about things that you don't
But I'm
know
talking
about.
On behalf of...
No, but in your school, have you had a problem, you've made recommendations, and those teachers have not been appointed?
No,
you've
not
had that problem?
No.
Okay. And I take it you would only recommend people who are capable?
That's right.
Thank you.
The inclusion policy, fortunately we do have... very strong psychologists at our district that do come in and assist us, but I think the class sizes is a big issue there. It's not so much the issue of the problem, it's the size of 40 children in the class when you've got to deal with one specific problem. And I did have that problem of the autistic child at the beginning of the year. At the time when I wrote it, that child has moved on to a special ed school at this stage. Hopefully we'll be back in the normal school because most autistic children do cope at a later stage.
Can I just ask you, that specialized school that the child has now moved to, is that a government school or is it a private school?
No, that is a government school.
Okay, so there are those kinds
but
of
But we are finding that they are insufficient at this stage, unfortunately, that they are not enough. And I think maybe it was because inclusion was supposed to include all the children into our schools, that the emphasis has fallen away from having specialized schools. And I just think that possibly we need to look at that, maybe even just to bridge the backlog in remedial cases that seem to be growing on a daily basis. And we don't have the schools or the manpower
to help. Remedial, now that you raise this thing, because I gather from having chatted to many principals and teachers, that they not only is a need for special schools to deal with special kind of learning type difficulties. In the Western Cape, for example, you have a lot of kids who suffer from fecal alcohol syndrome, and teachers clearly can't cope. Autism, dyslexia, all of those things are kind of special needs schools. But equally, you've heard what the previous speaker has said about revising concepts and repeating them and so on, and the curriculum not providing space for them. Do you find increasingly your teachers are asking for remedial schools or remedial classes and so on as well?
Unfortunately, that is on the increase. It's something I'm fairly fortunate that I've got three or four qualified remedial teachers on the staff, which makes my life a lot easier. but it's not the situation with all schools. I've got a very good working relationship with one of the remedial schools in our area, and nine times out of ten, the child that we send across for 9 months, a year, maybe 18 months, that child eventually comes back and goes back into the mainstream, and there's no problem because we have got this very good working relationship, and it works well. But what I'm saying is I think there's a need for a few more, and definitely for a few more teachers to become qualified. It's a specialized training that teachers do need, and I don't think teachers are going into that area, unfortunately.
An in-house sort of remedial system. You actually have to go to another school, which is called a remedial school, yeah?
As I said, I'm very fortunate. I do have remedial staff. So
we do have our own,
but we do also send to the remedial schools. But not all schools are in the fortunate position. I was fortunate that I even had a full-time psychologist on my staff at one stage as well, but that was a luxury, and it's something that you can't keep all the time. I think I handled the issue of the language. The bullying issue. The bullying issue is mainly due to physical size of some of the children, and that is why we try as tall possible, try and almost keep the children of the same size together, but it's not possible. But most certainly in our grade R, grade naught facility that we run, we keep the children of the same age, same physical development together in groups, and we find that reduces the bullying. I just have not got brave enough to actually attempt that in grade one yet. I'm not too sure how well that would go down, but I'd like to do that in the grade one class and group the children according to their ages as well. I think that would also solve a problem. But nevertheless, you still do not get away from the problem once the children go out into the playground. And then the younger children are mixing with the bigger children. You separate playgrounds, et cetera, which does help. But it's also a role that the teachers play. And if teachers are fully aware of it, you can actually nip bullying in the bud. But it's something that you have to be on top of all the time.
Thank you very much for that. Very useful comments, and clearly, as I say, the one thing we want to follow up with you is this issue of your district support and so on. And I look forward to getting some more detail in that regard, as I invited you to do. Thank you very much for your participation, Ms. Murray, and please convey our best wishes to all of your staff and learners at Muirdale Primary, and we do hope that you go from strength to strength.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Could we go on to the next submission, which is from Sia Hamba, Foundation for Academic Excellence, Professor Higa? And you're going to be telling us about learning skills.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and ladies and gentlemen, for this wonderful opportunity to address you on, I think, something completely different that you have dealt with so far, maybe. And this is founded on research that we did, so it's very practical. May I just also ask you, Madam Chair, if I may have 5 minutes extra, or to the 10? Okay. I would also like to mention that about 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting with the Minister of Basic Education, Ms. Mocheka, and she was very impressed with it and also requested us to align it with the curriculum for life orientation. But we found it also advisable to address you and present this proposal to include it in your final report, if you
would like to do that, but so that you may be informed of what is also on the table. I am representing Siamba Foundation for Academic Excellence. It's a non-profit organization, and our board of non-remunerative directors are Patatani Kumalo. You may know her. If you don't, please watch her talk show Wednesday evenings, 8 o'clock on SABC 3. And then the other members. We did some investigation into this matter of high failing rate, and this were our findings. Teachers never thought of teaching learners learning skills. They assumed that learners have to be naturally good at learning. At present, we do not have an officially endorsed program to remedy this. There is a dire need for educational material to teach learners learning skills in order to improve the outcomes of their academic performance. Remedial programs to be introduced to learners from grades 10 and upwards. Then we also found that the majority of learners do not know how to read for learning purposes, memorize properly, study for tests and examinations, write tests and examination papers, do assignments, deal with stress before and during examination. This is a very important aspect. And so also to utilize their time wisely before and while writing tests. For instance, they may spend half an hour on a question of 5 points. And they don't know how really to prioritize and plan their time. They also don't have a vision for the future. They don't know how to become self-motivated, and they don't know how to prepare themselves to become successful in life. As you know, it is our youth's greatest need, quality education. Now let us have a look at our education system, starting with the learners at the heart of education and the education department. We have, first of all, as first component, the curriculum. Then we have educators, the facilities, books, and apparatus. And, Madam Chair, it is also a fact that when we think of improving the education system, these are the main things, or if not the only things, that we focus on. So, improve that. But the question is, what about our learners? To also focus on them. The analogy that I use is like a motor race. You can have the best driver, you can have the best staff, equipment, track, but if the car is not fine-tuned, you won't win the race. And this, what we offer, is a tool to fine-tune the learner so that they can perform at a greater level. So our aim is to increase the academic performance of our learners by teaching them learning and life skills. Now, this is very important, life skills as well. I'll come to that later on. Now, this is our proposal to meet the need. This book has been written by me. I've been working on this for about 2 years, and it is aimed at learners in grade 10, 11, and 12. There is also a educator's manual to help the teacher to present these programs. There is just a short profile of mine. I don't want to burden you too much with that, just some highlights. I've been teaching at a high school also, and then at the university. I have drawn on my experience, academical and practical, professional, of about 45 years. And I have the privilege of presenting these training programs to leaders from about 65 countries in the Institute of which I am a senior faculty member, in the training centers in Maui, Hawaii, Singapore, and other African countries. I have authored more than 50 books. The bestseller was You and Your Child's Self-Image. The most important thing to mention in this regard, Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen, is that I have a passion for the development of human potential, especially our young people, to work with them while they're still young. The landscape of this program is recognition of learners and educators' prior learning and to increase their knowledge as well as adding on to their learning and life skills. Each learner has the inborn ability to become a top academic performer with guidance. Mentor, once again, my personal experience, I started with teaching in the middle of a year and at high school, and the principal made me responsible for standard, at that time, 7, which is grade 9, in bookkeeping. And he said to me, listen, these children have all failed, so don't worry if they don't pass. I could not accept this. Just to let it go. And I don't blow my own horn, but just to make it practical, it was true. Not one of them passed the previous examination. But I spent time with them. I built their self-image. And I really went out of my way to teach them with practical material as well. And thankfully, not one of them, they were over 30, failed in bookkeeping that year. The school principal didn't want to accept this. He didn't believe it, but he verified it, and they found that it is true. So it was not just a matter of coincidence. Then also the empowerment of the educators. A program to teach our learners learning skills only does not suffice. It must be sustained by personal development skills. The most successful people have this in common. They have spent much time in honing their skills and working on their personal development. That's why I say it is not enough just to teach learners learning skills. There are various programs on the market, but as far as I could ascertain, they all focus on teaching learners study skills. So this is what is making this book unique from others. Our focus is to increase the passing rate of learners, which is of much concern today for the department and the government, especially also Mr. Jacob Zuma, our president. To improve the outcomes of learners' academic performance by teaching them learning and life skills, developing their vast potential, equipping them with knowledge and skills to handle the challenges of life successfully, and then also the orientation of leaders. We follow a holistic approach because, as I have mentioned, it is not only focusing on learning skills, but personal development skills. Part one of the Learner's Book workbook, let me just go briefly over that, is a non-religious, non-political, holistic approach written in a simplistic, understandable language. It's a practical workbook with activities facilitating internalizing of knowledge and developing of skills. It is unique to South Africa, as I've already mentioned. It's authored by a South African professor for our learners, for South African learners. Now, when I was lecturing at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, this was one of the main objections, that we are using American literature. Outcomes, it is outcomes-based approach by specifying learning outcomes at the beginning of each of the 15 modules and formative assessment after each module. Then part two of the book or the program is a comprehensive training manual enabling educators to present the program with minimal training. It empowers educators to upgrade their knowledge base and develop their teaching and learning skills in a simplistic, logical, and step-by-step fashion. They don't need to do research. They don't need to spend extra time on acquiring knowledge. It is all there in this book. It's an instrument for educators in service training, conducive to their own personal professional growth and development to perform maximally, and especially to build their self-confidence. It's capacity building of educators as they go, adding value to their personal development, especially to build their self-confidence. Now, the benefits of the program, let me just briefly go over this. Increasing the outcomes of learners' personal and, in particular, their academic performance with whatever it is at present. So even your high-performance students will also benefit from this. They can even perform academically better. Increasing the passing rate of our learners throughout the grades, from grade 10, of course. A better-equipped student for tertiary training institutions to improve the passing rate of students. I'm sure you may be aware of it, but I've visited some of the universities. I've read an article by Professor Augustine from the University of Natal where he quoted statistics, and as I say, I verified it at different universities. The passing rate of students to pass their course within the prescribed period of time is 17% to 18%. It's what can I say? I say heartbreaking. Now, this is ascribed to the fact that, as Professor Augustine said, the schools do not produce university caliber students. That's what I say. I quote him. An improved basic and higher education system and adult learning. May I just mention, Madam Chair, that I'm also presenting this program to students at the South African Police College. So that's why I also say adult learning. A better educated learner will, as a more competent worker, contribute to improved productivity and consequently our economy as well as the development of our country. President Jacob Zuma said this, education remains my government's first priority. It is our most powerful weapon against the struggle against poverty. And then at all the successful countries in the world did one thing in common. They invested in education. It is the one thing that ensures long-term sustainable progress. Success in education will make it easier to achieve our goals in the other four priorities. Our proposition is this, and we are firmly believing this. Every learner can improve the outcomes of their personal and academic performance, whatever it is at present, by internalizing the knowledge and developing the skills explained in this workbook. Madam Chair, there are 15 modules. First of all, developing a positive belief system. This is so important that a learner, any person, must believe in himself, and he must have a positive belief system. May I just share my own experience with you again? Manchur, I grew up as a very poor boy, rural area, not having even money for shoes, went to school barefoot. We were very poor. I was raised on a government allowance, and I had a dream to get myself out of this poverty. But when I enrolled for high school, I did not enroll for math because I believe I don't have what it takes. Halfway in my school career, I discovered that I cannot realize my dream because I cannot go to university without matriculation exemption. Long story short, one of the teachers, my biology teacher, as well as the school's math teacher, played a very important role in my life. She said to me, John, I would offer to give you extra classes during the July holiday. And I will start with algebra, because that's a foundation. If you can grasp algebra, you will make it. After a week, she said to me these encouraging words. It's a life-changing words. John, you've got it. You've got what it takes. Then I had to change my belief system. I cannot do, I can. Because of the input of one single teacher. So that's why I say, it was also mentioned, Madam Chair, that I wrote this book from personal experience and academic experience as well. Unleashing, the second chapter is unleashing the tremendous power of your brain. If only I had known at that time what immense brain capacity I have. And if you have time, I would like to introduce this, but let me just mention this in passing. Also, the third chapter is improving your memory through memory exercises, effective mind management. And so once again, this is, to my mind, one of the most important tools, skills, a person can have. Because, once again, it's very closely associated with your belief system. What you say is what you will get. Now, I don't intend or mean to say that whatever you say, you will have. You will have to put your best into it. But if you have a negative mindset, do you think you will perform well in an examination? No. But if you believe, and if you tell yourself, but I can, then you will go with more enthusiasm about it, more energy, more convincing that you will make it. Now, we refer to the most important tool in this regard as cognitive restructuring, although I don't use that because it's a very high, what can I say, ununderstandable term. We refer to mind management. Improved reading skills is the focus of chapter 5. Improved study skills, writing tests and examination papers, and then doing excellent assignments. This was especially pointed out to me by teachers. The learners do not know how to do an assignment. Also by universities, the students do not know how to do an assignment. And we are focusing on this and simultaneously on improving their writing skills. So hopefully we will have some very good qualified authors and so on. Effective time planning, that's what I already mentioned. And then also reducing anxiety and managing stress before and during writing of tests and examinations. We also focus on vision, mission, and goal formulation. This is to help them to dream. And we make it very practical to them with practical examples. Increasing their level of motivation. The person without motivation is a car without an engine. No destination, no scenery. Then, chapter 13, releasing the sleeping giant within you. That is where we deal with the learner's self-image, which has been proven by scientific research that it is the most single factor to determine a person's success. And then the second last one, experiencing the healing power of forgiveness. If you don't forgive, you know, it is like drinking poison, hoping the other person would die. But you are doing a lot of damage to yourself because unforgiveness is a mental block preventing you from reaching your full potential. The last chapter, Madam Chair, is becoming outstandingly successful in all areas of your life. That, Madam Chair, concludes my presentation. I thank you very much. If there were time, I would have... Let me just say this. The benefits of making academic top performers of our youth cannot be measured in terms of monetary considerations. Let us leave, we plead with you, let us leave our youth a legacy to rise academically, to higher, to greater heights by means of a good education. And let us just take notice of what our very honored former state president
Mr. Nelson Mandela said in this regard. Education is a great engine of personal development. It is through education that the daughter of a peasant can become a doctor, that the son of a mine worker can become the head of the mine, that the child of farm workers can become the president. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Professor Higgins, on that very inspiring note. I'm sure everybody is very anxious to engage with you. We have 10 minutes. Mrs. Mushwana, Dr. Klopas-Lawrence, Mr. Makabela, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Professor, actually, for lecturing to us. Thanks. I'm listening, and I imagine life orientation back in the classroom. It has a lot of modules, but yours is dealing with one item. I want to understand that, meaning to increase the learner's performance. But then the books that they sell at school should include dealing with attitudes, you know, HIV and AIDS and stuff. So that this might be good for educators and not necessarily learners, according to me. And I'm checking if you can convince the schools as well, because books are given to educators to choose from by booksellers, and if they choose it, then the book goes. But looking at this book, they may not necessarily choose it for the learners, because I think it's good for workshops, unless if I'm missing it. Now my question is, are you able to write another book with summary of these as introduction for the learners and try to make schools, I mean, they're going to choose, if they choose wisely, they might choose this book, so it will be sold and be used in schools. Otherwise, I think it's a very good book, and we need the results to get better in South Africa. And I'm adding my voice to that of the president and the minister and many other people, that the results are something of concern in this country. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Professor Higgins, you're not related to Henry Higgins, are you?
Well, he was my son. Professor Henry.
Yes. Do you have any scientific results or statistics on the success of this concept of yours or book? Or that is very important to me. What are the results? And my second comment and question is, do you mainly focus on generic skills, learning skills, in your book or in your program, as opposed to specific study skills when it comes to subjects? I think it's the task of each and every teacher to teach their learners exactly how to study their specific subject. In other words, subject-specific learning skills. That's so, so important. And then another question, do our teachers get trained in the different learning theories at our universities currently? Thank you.
Just a few things I may want to understand with this Academy of Excellence. Just the first, whether there's a center where you're teaching or you're dealing with research or exactly what. I know as you presented, later on you dwelt more on your own book. And I don't think the agency is about that. I think, yes, the book is appreciated, but equally, outside of the book, I think there's something which Siyamba Foundation does, and so on. The second, which is related to the first, is that when I went through your submission, I pick up a tune that says you're not happy with the manner in which provincial administrations received the book, that in your own view, you wanted this book to be part of the mainstream education material to be distributed. And I think what some of the officials at the national level of the department did was to say to you that the discretion whether the book can necessarily be utilized or not should rest with the provincial administrations. And I don't necessarily think there's something wrong with that, because there could be many, so many such materials, and it will indeed be even be for that specific learner to may opt for the book or any other, not necessarily in position, but it does assist, yes, it may assist, but it could be part to many other material. I think when at one point you were being encouraged to even write as South African professors and academics, it was more to encourage our own people as well to compete. Those kind of materials which may be from either America or elsewhere, which we have done a good job. But that, I don't think it was more to say, sort of guaranteed writers or authors of this kind of material to necessarily say you would get the book. I think in that you also expect the book to be sold, isn't it? It's being sold. So it does not necessarily come cheap. It may be that even those schools individually, they may not necessarily have the necessary funds to even acquire or get this particular book. But you can as well, for interest sake, tell us how much the book cost. Thanks.
Education 2 weeks ago, which has asked you to incorporate some aspects of these modules into the life orientation curriculum from grade 10 to 12. Maybe you want to give us some details about that. What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that you'll be looking at revising the curriculum with the department? You know, what does that mean practically speaking? And then just generally, you know, while I understand, I must say that I've always been pretty partial to self-motivation type books and material, because I think they're quite invaluable. But I find that given the enormous socio-economic problems we have in the country, that the stresses are felt much earlier than grade 10. On the part of many kids. Language, you've heard, is a huge problem to many kids. Now, not all of us, even if we are introduced to a second language like English at an early age, are able to equally grasp a different language easily. Already that is a huge demotivating factor, I would imagine, already from a very young age. The issue of social stresses in our societies, various societies, they abound. And I would have thought that, this kind of guidance almost, and I don't want it to be confused with the kind of guidance classes I used to have when I was in school, but this kind of personal development would be helpful, surely, at a much younger age. What are your thoughts?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would gladly respond to these queries. Yes, matter of convincing schools is a big problem because we do not have the infrastructure to communicate with every school in the country. What we did so far was to approach the provincial departments of education, and some of them were very enthusiastic about it. Among others, Dr. Nyker from the Western Cape, Chief Director, FET. But the problem is, number one,
they ask me the first question, is it on the national catalogue? Now, my negotiations with the Department of Education, Basic Education, for about the past 2 years, the book as such do not qualify to be on the national catalogue. But they emphasize that it can be purchased by the provincial departments as learning support material. But I don't know if I couldn't convince them, because every time they come back to the national catalogue. So it is a very big problem. And then what about another book, Madam Chair? As I've already mentioned, I have written over 30 books. And this, in this field, is just a start. So yes, I often, when people ask me, have you retired? I said, yes, I have retired. I've just put on new tires. So I am still going strong about writing. And then what about specific skills or generic skills? Specific skills or skills for specific subjects? No, I don't concentrate on that, because this is a generic approach that they can apply to all subjects. What I do in this book is to explain the 8 different types of intelligence and how they can apply this to their learning. So it is a generic approach. It would be impossible for me, because I'm not an expert on the other subjects, to give them guidance on that. Training of teachers, yes, that is our next step also. We would like to see this book introduced in tertiary educational institutions, but we haven't touched on that because we're so busy with this present program. Outside activities apart from the book, I think you mean by that if we are training other people. As I mentioned already, I have presented this with very great acclaim to the South African police students, just under a different name, to become an academic top performer. And it was also, I had very good comments. One is here. Your self-empowerment guide to becoming a top performer is a very practical and user-friendly guide which I found to be effective and relevant to everyday use in achieving my optimum ability. And we also did include some of the some learners, but Madam Chair, our biggest constraint is money. We need money to do research on this. So to answer the question on research and statistics also, I have conducted a research or an investigation into the effect of this book among police students before and after the evaluation of their self-concept and also their driving force. That is actually their locus of control. If you have an inner or an external driving force, you must change to internal if it's high on external. And yeah, there were big changes in this regard. And once again, I say, self-image is a most important single factor in determining success. And there was an improvement as far as this is concerned. Now, yes, to sell the books and the price of that is, that depends on the quantity. We have a sliding scale, so it depends on the quantity. If we have an order of 100,000 books, I think the production or the selling price would be in the range of 90-95 rand per book, that inclusive. And then about the curriculum, the revising of that, Madam Chair, I don't know, because we have been informed that the curriculum, even for life orientation, they are busy revising this, and it will be available middle of next month. So I really don't know, and I have had a look at the books prescribed for learners, and I did not see much space for including all of these aspects. So I really don't know. I think I may be in for a surprise as well. And then your comment on self-improvement books, yes, I'm also in favor of that on condition that it must offer opportunities for activities to put into practice what you have learned. Otherwise, it's not of much use. You must, I think if I'm correct, you remember about 5% of what you hear, and then more you see, what you feel, but about 100% of what you see, what you hear, and etc., 100% of all these, if it is visible and also offering opportunities for practical application. What about lower grades? Yes, we know about the need. And once again, this is not the beginning and the end. We want to also expand this. But it would require a different approach to include these younger learners. But it's in our long-term planning. And then what about the language? Yes, at present it is in English, but we also aim at eventually have this translated in all the main languages. In other words, other African languages as well. I hope I have answered all the queries satisfactorily.
Can I just clarify? You know, the question that I asked with regard to the ministers is something that you said during the submission. You said you met with the minister. In your response to my question, you said you're not sure now what the outcome of that is going to be. But you did mention that the minister had requested that some of these modules be incorporated into the revised curriculum. So I take it that what you are unsure about is that you're not doing it. It's the department's been asked to take some of your ideas and incorporate it.
Correct.
That's right.
I have no share in planning or revising.
No, I understand. I just want to get it quite clearly so that when we do our report, we are quite ad idem on what it is that you said, and that I don't misquote you. So she has basically asked that the department look at your book and try and incorporate some of that.
I must do that myself.
You must do it.
Yes.
And you don't know how that's going to happen.
I'll only have the new curriculum by the middle of August. That's why I say I'm not too sure what will be included in the new curriculum as far as learning skills are concerned and personal development.
So, Professor, who's going to include learning skills into that curriculum, the revised one that's coming out at the end or the middle of next month?
It must be the department.
It's the department, not you.
No, not at all.
Okay. So, and what was the minister's request again?
She said that we must align this with the new curriculum. So
you must align your book.
Yes, we must align the book.
Not the curriculum.
No.
Okay, okay. All right. Sorry, I misunderstood then. I thought you were tasked to do something particular with regard to the curriculum.
I wish we could.
I stand corrected. Dr.
I just need some clarity on the scientific results. You mentioned the SAS group, the before and the after, the same group. Do you have statistics on an experimental group as opposed to a control group? That's so important.
I do know, as a scientist myself, social scientist, I know the importance of this. But once again, we are limited by finances. And I only can use that limited time that the college provide me with. And it's very, very limited. But I know what you know. The commissioner expressed also his need that we have an experimental group, that we present this program to certain number of classes and compare their results with the others. But no, we haven't done that yet. It will. We really do know it. Yes. But we are waiting for, we are
approaching sponsors to try and raise the money, especially for a research project. And I've already negotiated with an organization that specializes in this regard. But it's money. And we don't have it. Madam Chair, may I just mention that I would gladly hand you a copy of this book, and also I have a CD.
Thank you very much.
Especially would need it of my presentation.
The presentation that you've made here today.
Right.
Okay, that would be quite important for us to get, Professor. And thank you very much, members. This will be with Mr. Brown if anybody cares to borrow it, and so we'll keep it as a resource.
Yes.
This is the book. It's part one of two, Learner's Manual, grade 10 to 12. Yeah?
And Madam Chair, may I just apologize for the binding. It is temporary. It is printed on demand. And it's not a final printing, which will be better than that. So if the leaves come loose, you must know.
We will try and fix it up. Thank you very much. Do you want to go and check for that? I'm told that, go ahead. We're just trying to find out. There seems to have been a miscommunication, but it seems that the Center for Multigrade Education is not here. I did receive an apology from somebody, but there were two inputs, members, on multigrade schooling, which if my recollection, those of you who have the big book, do you guys have the big book? Yeah. If somebody can check, what is submission 180? Yeah. Is that the last submission in the book? 179. No. I'm not talking about this small book, Mr. Macabella. I'm talking about the big book, you know, one with all of the written submissions. Not the one that you would have received this week. I'm talking about the real, you know, we've got book one, book two, book three with all of the submissions right up to book five. Okay, so nobody's got any of those books with them. Okay, Mr. Brown, will you just double check with somebody? Tanya's not there though, eh? The reason I'm asking Mr. Brown to check up, there were two submissions, if my memory serves me well, when we were going through it. Remember I was saying to you that we sift through the submissions, the big books. And I seem to recall that there was a 179 and a 180, both of which, or a 181, something like that, very close to each other, both of which dealt with multigrade classes. And we had identified multigrade classrooms because it is a specific issue and we haven't really heard much about it. To recall, we raised this issue last week when we were in the department, and I even said, I think Mrs. Mashwana and Mr. Macubela or somebody raised it around multigrade and rural education. And I said to you, we'll be hearing some of that stuff from experts during the presentation this week. Now, in the week, I did get, I'd asked Mr. Brown to double-check because the one submission came without a covering letter. So it was almost sort of tucked in between, and because the photostatting was funny, you could just barely see that it was marked a separate index because that was a bit skew. And when I went through the books, I realized that this was a separate submission. And I pointed it out to Mr. Brown in the week, and I said what we needed to do was to have both of them coming, but make one presentation because they're essentially doing the same thing, but they were from two different organizations. And then in the week, I received an apology from Dr. Hubert, who now appears on the list of today, to say, look, he's overseas, and unfortunately, he can't make it today. And I then said, okay, look, we'll just continue with the other one. But it seems that, again, that other one has gotten lost somehow, and either we haven't invited that submission, or there was a confusion about that submission, and perhaps it couldn't be found when I wrote the instruction on my book. So what we're going to have to do is to actually invite that second submission that I said at some stage, and perhaps we'll do it next week, just for that one submission, because, as I say, it would be completely unfair not to give some airing to that topic. And so what I wanted to say, members, was that we don't have this submission here today, and we will have to try and find at least half an hour sometime next week to hear it on that topic, right? Mrs. Mashwana, you wanted to add something?
I wanted to check with you because I think the principal of Marydale, Mr. Yeah, he did speak very, it was not like a long presentation, but he did talk of multi-grade classes. It's not like you didn't. It was not
submission,
you.
It was Mrs. Huxon.
Okay, I wanted to request him to kindly.
Mrs. Huxon has had to leave.
Okay, thanks.
Because she has a flight to catch back to Durban. As you know, the flights are not that regular from Cape Town to Durban, and she had to leave earlier. But these were very specifically on research done in multi-grade classrooms. And in any case, we do have the written submissions, but I did think that it was important that we give this topic, and we all did, in fact, because we haven't heard on this topic. So we'll make arrangements next week if we have the opportunity to do so with regard to that one. And I do want to apologize to members in this regard. But the very next submission then is projects abroad. And I understand we don't have Ms. Trump, we have Mr. Mtembo. Is that right? Mr. Lyndon Mtembo. How do I spell that surname?
It's M-E.
M-E.
T-E.
T-E.
M for mother. B-O.
Okay. Mr. Brown has got an I somewhere in here. That's why I couldn't read it so well. That does look like an I. It looks like a double R-I. Okay. Thank you very much. Won't you proceed with your presentation, 10 minutes, and then we'll spend the rest of the time just engaging you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and to the committee, the Projects Abroad Human Rights Office, thank you for the opportunity to present our submission on the delivery of quality education in South Africa and challenges pertaining thereto. I should indicate that we interviewed principals and teachers from a range of primary and secondary schools in some of the most disadvantaged areas in Cape Town in order to draw up and present this to you, and it is their concerns and recommendations that are noted and summarized in it. For the purpose of this oral submission, I will just focus on the key areas, and where specific focus is needed, I will expand on it. While we do realize that the OBE system has effectively been abolished, I should point out that at the time, this was not the case, and our submission has a focus on the problems of the OBE system and how educators struggled with aspects of it. What you will discover, however, is that most of the issues are still relevant regardless of the OBE system. General problems arising from the education system as it stands is a lot of schools complain about the lack of funding and resources. Schools cited the following problems with the funding system, in that schools added to the no-fee list could suffer a significant drop in their level of fundings. Some schools with great financial need are in the same quintile for funding purposes as schools which are far wealthier and better resourced. And more often than not, these schools did not know what criteria has been used to determine their quintile and level of funding. There's a perception that exists that the better a school performs, the less funding it receives. And many schools cannot afford to maintain the few facilities that they already have, let alone expand and improve on it.
schools are also very concerned about the limited material resources at their disposal, such as lack of classrooms and furniture shortages, and lack of vital resources such as libraries, well-equipped science labs, and information technology. This limits the quality of the education they provide and impairs educators' ability to teach their subjects properly. Many educators point to a deficit in human capital as one of the most important factors affecting the quality of education. Every school we reviewed suffered from teacher shortages. Some of the problems that arise from the teacher shortages are classes are overcrowded, educators are teaching more classes each week, subjects are taught for fewer hours each week. More often than not, principals must also teach classes, and in certain instances, sometimes they were even teaching full-time, and this obviously will have an impact on the quality of the general administration of the school. Educators are teaching subjects that they are unqualified to teach, and some schools were even considering phasing out subjects such as science altogether because they have no qualified science teachers. Schools also desperately and urgently need psychologists or school counselors and qualified ELFIN educators to accommodate those with learning difficulties. Because we interviewed schools in historically disadvantaged areas, a lot of schools mentioned the personal and socioeconomic backgrounds of learners have a significant influence over their ability to succeed academically. The external factors militating against academic success by some learners include the prevalence of gangsterism and substance abuse, the relatively large number of learners with special needs due to conditions such as fetal alcohol syndrome, and the problems of scholies attacking students on their way to and from school. Learners struggle to learn when they can see gangs of robbers surrounding the school waiting for them to leave. These factors result in learners becoming less motivated to learn, to concentrate, and to study in their home environments. One of the key issues that schools raised was the forced promotion of learners. Schools were concerned that the National and Western Cape Education Departments pay more attention to the number of learners passing than the quality of the pass and the actual ability of the learner. Schools faced strong resistance from WCED representatives to their informed decisions that a learner should repeat a grade. Only one school reported that its decisions were generally respected by the WCED as long as the principal was assertive enough. Another issue is that there's a definite lack of opportunities for learners who are technically inclined. These learners' needs are neglected, and they graduate without the capacity for tertiary education or the qualifications for employment. The next subject deals with specific problems with the OBE system and its practical implementation. And as mentioned, I will not go into too much detail in this regard of the submission. If you are interested, it is in the detailed report that we submitted. Schools generally recognize the benefits of OBE in theory, but believe that it has been an overall failure in practice. In its current form, OBE is ill-suited to the circumstances in many schools. The practical implementation of this system continues to critically impair the quality of teaching and standards of achievement in learners. The OBE system needed to be discarded or revised to address these issues. Some of the issues are the individualization of curriculum content and standards of assessment. In practice, this approach created two main problems for educators. There was a lack of standardization of knowledge and assessment or PASS standards, and they more often than not reinforced existing inequalities. The instability and uncertainty in the implementation of OBE, the effect of the background of learners on OBE teaching, the insufficient and inadequate teacher training, the overwhelming administrative workload that OBE created on educators, unrealistic timeframes were set to teach content, class sizes was a big problem, and a lot of problems arose from the concept of inclusive learning. Some of the other issues that came up during our research. We were troubled by the apparent lack of a functioning cooperative relationship between the education departments on one side and individual schools and educators on the other. educators report that they often feel that they are in opposition to the education department rather than working together towards a common goal. The main reasons for the discord in this relationship appear to be a lack of respect for the experience of educators, a loss of faith in government, and a breakdown in the chains of communication. Another major problem was the instability and inconsistency in decision-making from government level. And this situation created the following problems. Each new appointment in the Department of Education brings a change in policy which creates instability within schools and affects the ability to function properly. Individual decision-makers lack practical experience and knowledge of the situation in schools, forming unsuitable and inappropriate policies. Inconsistent instructions are received from different individuals within the same department. An issue of concern with regards to school governing bodies, generally it is recognized that SGBs are extremely important and can be useful for supporting the school, but they feel that the 3-hour training session offered to parents by district officers are insufficient to overcome problems. The principals themselves are known to train the SGBs in some schools, creating an unhelpful dynamic where principals are considered super members of the body. Governing bodies of this kind are unable to effectively perform their given tasks, such as raising funds, vetting the budget, approving teacher appointments, and overseeing disciplinary hearings. The recommendations that came from the school. We at PARO support the proposals announced by President Zuma in his State of the Nation address. While we endorse these recommendations, particularly the undertaking to increase the number of much-needed teachers in maths and science, much more must be done to improve the education system in South Africa. The recommendations include to include schools and educators in the decision-making process and consult with them on matters of importance within the education system. Principals and educators have the practical experience necessary to make a highly valuable contribution to policy discussions and decision-making. Also to improve the working relationship and communication between different levels of the education system. To either replace the OBE system or revise it with a focus on its practical implementation in the unique conditions of South Africa. And to provide educators with better professional development. And here two types of training are being suggested. One was OBE specific, and the second was general professional development. Schools generally strongly support the call for educators to undertake retraining for a few months every 5 to 10 years. Teachers must be granted leave and be financially supported by the government for this training. To address issues related to funding and resource problems in school, we define 3 categories that can be focused on, namely funding, material resources, and human resources. Due to time limitations, I'm not going to go into too much detail, as these are suggested in the written submission. There's a need to revise education policies to focus more on the quality of the past rather than the fact of the past in and of itself. An approach focusing on the ability of the learner and their best interest academically is needed. The professional opinion and experience of educators should be given far greater weight than that of a government representative. Revise the structure of the education system to make provision for learners who are not academically inclined. We acknowledge that the cheaper and easier option of allocating more resources to schools to teach practical subjects within their standards curriculum may seem more appealing than the development of public technical secondary schools. However, the creation of technical secondary schools would be a far more efficient and effective allocation of resources. Reintroduce physical education and creative subjects into the curriculum, and in addition, provide schools with the human and material resources to support this change. Develop initiatives to assist learners from disadvantaged backgrounds. A comprehensive recommendation to address this problem arising from learners' backgrounds was outside the scope of this submission. However, we believe that the government should develop initiatives to combat the difficulty set out in Section 3.1.2. For example, building more public libraries which are better resourced, better staffed and can adequately accommodate all the learners in this area. Just to reiterate this point, I'm working with a group of youth in Mbokweni in Paarl, and speaking to 30 of them last week Wednesday, one of the major concerns that they have is that the library in the area is heavily under-resourced. If they present a project to their teacher, more often than not, they had to utilize the same textbook or the same resource, which creates the impression that they've copied from each other, which obviously has a negative impact on their scores. There's also a need to increase student safety by organizing police patrols of school zones at the start and end of the school day. Teachers complain that while students are volunteering to stay after hours to learn additional subject matters, they were scared to because of the problem of scholars waiting for them outside the gates once they leave. However, to this extent, we do recognize and applaud the efforts made by the Bambanani volunteers at schools in disadvantaged areas. The capacity of school governing bodies to effectively function within the school should be enhanced. Further, an adequate training should be provided, focusing on two main areas, capacity and skills. Teaching the governing body how members how to perform the tasks required of them, how to raise funds, vet the school budget, and participate effectively in disciplinary hearings, and also governance, to teach the basics of governance to increase confidence so that they can assume their position of authority and not feel inferior to the educators and principals. Our biggest recommendation is to introduce an independent school inspectorate with a focus on individual advice and support for schools. Pardon me. We support the intention behind President Zuma's proposal to introduce assessments by the Department of Basic Education of each school, but believe that this will not be the most effective way to improve the quality of education. There is a great deal of reluctance among schools towards the prospect of government assessments. The thought is that they would be more of a burden than a benefit, because they would provide unhelpful pressure more than they would provide assistance. However, schools are in desperate need of personalized assistance and support from a body which could consider and respond to the individual circumstances and needs of each school. Schools would like such a body to come and sit down with teachers and principals, observe classrooms, and discuss the particular challenges faced by that school, and to provide advice, support, and assistance where it is needed. A relationship of trust is needed between the inspector and the school, and mutual cooperation and assistance is a must. The inspector should be able to assist the school with its individual concerns and problems, not police schools, and act as a watchdog for the government. In order to achieve this relationship, the school's inspectorate would likely have to be an independent body, unaffected by political and personnel changes within the national and provincial education departments. Crucially, the school's inspectorate should not have any disciplinary or policing powers with regards to the school. Such a body could provide written audits to the government, but their primary role should be affecting change and improvement in schools. We thank you for the opportunity to lodge the submission.
Thank you very much. I really want to thank you for the efforts that your organization has put into these hearings. I'm not sure, though, from your submission, if you can maybe just tell me how many schools did you interview, and, you know, geographically an approximation?
We interviewed, well, our initial aim was to interview 16 schools, but due to time constraints, we narrowed it down to 8 schools. It was schools in Khayelitsha, Langa, Lavender Hill, Khayelitsha, Langa, Lavender Hill, as well as in the Athlone area. And a total of, as I mentioned, a total of 8 schools.
And they were high schools?
High schools and primary schools, ma'am.
And primary schools. So what was it, 4-4 or?
Yes, ma'am. I should also indicate that we did, our approach was to send letters and call schools to ask if they would be interested. And we did send letters to former Model C schools and private schools to also be incorporated into the research, but we did not receive a positive response from them.
That's fine. And even eight schools, it's a lot of work. But it gives me a good idea as to the extent of the representations that have emanated from these schools and particularly geographically where they emanate from and so on. I wanted to find out your organization, and, you know, I don't know too much about it, and there may be a reason why I don't know too much about it. Maybe on that, like in 5 seconds, just give me a good sense of who you are, what you normally do outside of trying to make input sentences practice.
Projects Abroad as an umbrella body is an international volunteer placement organization. We have 21 recruitment officers internationally, with one also based in South Africa. In South Africa alone, we've got 6 projects. We've got a journalism project, a building project, a care project, teaching project, a sports program, as well as the Human Rights Office. The Human Rights Office is the largest project of the projects abroad parent body worldwide. Volunteers come in from, as I mentioned, 22 different areas. We have a legal services department within the office, as well as a social justice department, of which I'm the social justice coordinator. My job is to provide the international volunteers with practical and relevant experience of what issues impact and affect the human rights work that NGOs and organizations on the ground do in South Africa. With regard to submissions, Madam Chair, we recognize that a lot of organizations, NGOs, are heavily underfunded, under-resourced, and do not necessarily have the staff to compile reports of this nature. So we take it upon ourselves to do the research and provide a voice for them.
So basically, yours is a placement organization for volunteers coming from other countries to do volunteer work here, and you would assist with coordinating where they go and so on, primarily in the NGO sector. I understand. Thank you very much. Members' questions? Mr. Makubela, Dr. Klopas-Lawrence. Thank you.
Sorry, I thought it's fine. Just to understand why it seems you never interviewed the departmental officials. Is there a reason for that?
So I fully agree with your suggestions on the school inspectorate. I really do appreciate your views on the inspectorate. And just 2 short questions. You referred to the library problems in Paul. Was that a provincial library, or was that a school library you referred to? And then the other question is on, it's paragraph 4.9 of your document. You referred to reintroduce, apart from physical education, creative subjects. Would you please elaborate on that?
And if you can maybe note the following questions, I won't speak that quickly. Let me know when you're ready. Okay. A lot of your input is about resources, and frankly, just when was it? On Monday, I met with representatives of about 9 different schools in the Athlone area alone. And the first thing that you hear from schools is resources. And clearly there's a major need. I mean, we're a democracy in transition. We're 15 years down the line. We've had, I think it was 23 different systems of education in this country just a mere 15 years ago. It's hard to believe. And we've moved for the first time into a single national matric exam. What was that, last year? And so clearly we're still a transitional democracy. If you look at our budget, the education budget from a national perspective, we were at the department last week and we took a submission on this. 2/3 of the budget goes to teacher salaries, which leaves scarcely, you know, what's left over has to go to meet everybody's demands, from infrastructure to maintenance to textbooks to you name it, school nutrition programs, that kind of thing. I wonder whether there isn't a need, particularly from the NGO sector, to really start, you know, because it doesn't help me as a politician, frankly, standing up and saying, look, man, if we start paying teachers' salaries and start increasing them in the way that they would like, and frankly, I would like, I mean, a lot of my family are teachers, but if we were to do that, reducing learner-teacher ratios would be impossible because we can't afford as a country to employ more teachers. Fundamental concept, because that has a direct relationship on quality outcomes. You've heard today, you've got a very rural school, but because they're able to get individual attention, regardless of the social problems, regardless of the language problems, regardless of any problems, they're able to produce successful students. Now that is very, very, they don't even have resources, as the lady says. They don't have computers, they don't have libraries, they don't have all of those things. So all of these sort of fancy issues and what I would like to call sexy issues around building libraries in schools and so on, for me is besides the point. The point is, how do we get our teachers to be able to maximize what they can do in the classroom and so on? And that has very centrally to do with class size. So that's a central issue. So resources, everybody can do a wish list. And I, you know, from my side, and I'm sure everybody in education in the department, certainly the DG, would like to give everybody what they want. But it's simply not possible, particularly given the situation that we have with two-thirds of your budget going to salaries. And we are, interestingly, spending more on education than any other department. So, you know, here you've got teacher salaries, you've got the rest of it, which is one-third of your budget. So I wonder whether, in fact, the NGO sector shouldn't come to terms with some of those issues, really, and start the ball rolling on and discussing, you know, almost a kind of a national debate on some of these issues. Because we tend to kind of romanticize when we say, oh, well, you know, district officials not supporting us, blah, blah, and that may be true. I mean, you know, I'd be the last person to say, well, you know, poor district officials. But they themselves are under enormous strain. We had a district official here from KwaZulu-Natal making a presentation to this committee, and he says, I've got 600 schools that I have to visit. How on earth can I do it? Again, it comes down to, can we afford to employ more people to support those schools? No, we can't, simply because we have a huge problem. So resources are one issue, and I do think that given that you're in the NGO sector, given that you're almost kind of straddling a whole lot of issues, and given that yours is a socioeconomic portfolio, I think it would be really wonderful if your organization were to consider doing some of that kind of research as well, and then kind of compiling, and especially because a lot of what you do is advocacy. You know, and sometimes we tend to glean over some of these really important issues that really hold us back from establishing major transformation. So that's the one thing that I do want to say to you. The second issue is, you know, I have been terribly concerned about the fact that we have what I would call an academic stream only. Now, you raised the issue of, and we've heard today, and even yesterday we heard about the different types of intelligences and different types of learning that can happen. And clearly, and I always use the analogy, I say, well, if all of us here in the room were told we're going to do archery tomorrow, and we all go there and we've never done archery before, about a third of us would excel because that's just how we built. Upper body strength, hand-eye coordination, all of that stuff. The rest of us would have to put in tremendous effort in order to just get by with archery. Why? Because that's human nature. That's what makes us different from each other. We learn differently. We are different and so on. We have different skills. And likewise, in school, what we're doing is by analogy just saying, look, we have archery or nothing else. And that's why you always find about a quarter of a classroom flourishes and the rest need a lot of help and some more than others. And so we don't create the kind of learning environments that allow more people to flourish. And so this idea of saying, you know, how do we accommodate students who are technically skilled, who learn by doing as opposed to listening and writing or reading? They learn by doing. They can acquire the same skills. They can acquire the same mathematical abilities, scientific abilities, but they learn differently. They don't learn by, you know, sitting and listening to a teacher in a classroom or reading a textbook. And that is very, very crucial. And I certainly would like to know whether you have, as an organization or yourself personally, looked at different models. I know that internationally we just, as a committee, starting to look at some of these models. But that is a debate, I think, that we're going to have to start having in this country, because I believe very strongly that what we're doing with the education system is just flawed tremendously. If your matric is of a standard that it is, and it's quite a high standard internationally speaking, and it's geared towards laying the foundation for further and higher academic learning, then the outcomes that we have actually are meant to feed into universities. And if you look at the outputs of our school system, last year we had 60% of our matrics passing. Of the 60%, I'd imagine about 20% of that number would be absorbed in higher education institutions. What about the rest? What opportunities are there for them, and so on? So if our schools are not skilling young people to go into the workforce, then your matric is not worth much to the majority of matriculants. And so that's a really, I think, fundamental question that we all will need to start grappling with sooner rather than later. Just your thoughts, if any, and given that you're a young person, maybe you can speak on behalf of young people.
I hope they don't hold me accountable. Just to answer the questions from the top, the reason we did not interview department officials was basically just due to time constraints. And we felt it's more important for the voices of those that work in historically disadvantaged communities to be heard. By the nature of our office, we have a high turnover of volunteers. And the submission, from what I can remember, we put the notices up in our office, on the notice board, and we highlight the submissions to the volunteers on a constant basis. And the volunteers, the one leading was actually from Australia, her name is Maddie, picked up on this with about 3.5 weeks of her stay left. And so based just on her timeframes and on the timeframes of the submission, we decided, as I mentioned, to focus rather on key areas. But we do realize that is a major exclusion in our submission. To answer your question, ma'am, it's a provincial library that they were referring to. With regards to the question, sports and creative, I think a lot of the teachers specifically were referring to art classes, because there's a desperate need for that in the schooling system. And to refer to some of your points, there's a number of NGOs that are really keen and interested to engage, especially in the Western Cape, to engage and work with schools to not necessarily place an extra burden on schools, but to actually relieve the burden from schools in order to address the issues such as the lack of sports and creative classes. Two examples I can name, because I worked for one organization and through that I came into contact with another, is the Cape Craft and Design Institute that some of you might be familiar with. They're based in Harrington Street. They are actually conducting research into the needs of a art and creative component into the education system. And I would suggest that you interact with them and their director, Ms. Erica Elk, and I hope she will forgive me for being for suggesting that. The other is the Visual Arts Network of South Africa, VANSA, and they are literally around the corner from the Cape Craft and Design Institute. And they are, like I said, they're really interested, and it's a major concern for them as well that there's a lack of creative education in the schooling system. And I also feel that if the Department of Education, the Department of Social Development, Department of Arts and Culture are willing to work together to say, if Arts and Culture say, we'll fund CCDI to run these sorts of programs in schools, and the Department of Education is not necessarily willing to give money, but to avail resources, and this goes back to your point as well, then I think a program such as that has great potential. Earlier on in this year, with the great concern regarding the six-week holiday program, or the six-week holiday during the FIFA World Cup, we did a bit of a research in terms of what can be done to keep kids occupied. And one idea that we had is basically to, and this is once again directly linked to this, a lot of the schools complain that we've got sports fields, we get sporting equipment, but we don't have coaches. We don't have referees to actually teach the kids, and it places undue stress on teachers to still fulfill that role as well. I contacted SAFA, Cricket South Africa, the South African Rugby Football Union, Volleyball South Africa, the Netball Association, and the agreement was that they will offer free level one coaching training to interested members from these from historically disadvantaged communities, provided that each person that they train reaches an agreement with the school or with a sports club to conduct 1 year of training in that community. If, based on an assessment then at the end of that 1 year by Cricket South Africa and the NGO, if they are satisfied with the level of commitment and performance by that individual, the level two certificate of training would be provided free of charge until you have a core group of professionally trained coaches and referees, umpires that can be utilized by schools. And in so doing, you actually generate more benefits to the general sporting community of South Africa as well. You have, with regards to resources, Madam Chair, I think something, and I was privileged to sit in a number of these interviews, it's not so much that teachers were complaining about their salaries. It's just that, and I think maybe they wouldn't want to, because then it raises questions such as you posed. But it's just that they would like more input in terms of where the resources go to. And it provides a golden opportunity for the top tier of government to actually then challenge teachers, if you can put it that way, to say, but yeah, we would love to buy more textbooks. We would love to hire more teachers, but this is the reality. And perhaps incorporate the trade unions, which is obviously a very important factor in that regard as well, into that sort of discussions. With regards to what you mentioned, Madam Chair, in terms of academic stream, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Professor Ken Robinson. He's a British academic, and he presented a lecture in Los Angeles last year. And he said some of the biggest problems that is faced in the education system is that we treat the education system like a fast food conglomerate. We produce quick, easy, accessible to all systems that is not nutritionally healthy for our children. What we should go back to, we should move away from a mass manufacturing approach to a more, and he called it an agricultural approach. It's organic. It is completely dependent on the soil, i.e. the area, and the school that, and the community where the schools are based. And then that should actually determine how the education system is developed. I hope I answered all questions. Final point, Madam Chair, with regards to the research that you suggested, I would love to take that on, and if possible, could I set up a meeting with you so that we can go into more detail and see what you really want out of it?
It can always be a resource for the committee and its activities as well. You can speak to Mr. Brown thereafter, but just the last issue, you raised very importantly the issue of gangsterism and drugs and so on. Do you know of any NGOs or any community-based efforts, particularly on the Cape Flats, people who are making a difference in those communities, whether they are organized or whether they, you know, affiliated to just community organizations?
Personally, I do not know, Madam Chair. One of my students just recently conducted, as in last week, finished a research paper on the impact that drugs have on disadvantaged communities. If you want, I can send you that report. But one, just to summarize that, her result was that it is such a complicated issue because it's not just the negative impact that the gangsterism and substance abuse has, but a lot of what communities perceive to be positive impacts. For example, in Retreat, there is a drug den, call it that, and the gentleman that owns that, he has no substances, illegal substances, in his house, but he stores it at different houses along the same street. And what he does, he buys the children PlayStation 3s, Xboxes, and you get DVDs, and you get flat-screen TVs. So every time there's a raid on his house, nothing gets found, even though the whole community knows that he is a drug dealer. So it needs an integrated approach, and what the research indicates is that the approaches that are currently being utilized is too single-focused on either the seller or the user, but not actually on the whole community as such.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for your participation. One of the things that we will obviously have to look at is trying to, as a portfolio committee, try and optimize our relationships with organizations that are based in our communities and so on, so that you yourself can be a resource to the committee. We are an oversight committee, by and large, and so without information, we are ineffective. And so a lot of what transpires in these hearings is about building relationships as well. So I do hope you have Mr. Brown's details and so on, and I do hope that we would have a more dynamic communication from and to yourself. Thank you very much, and thank you to all of you who have participated today. And thank you again, Mr. Fisser, for being here. And members, we are hopefully going to meet on Tuesday now. 2 o'clock, when?
I'm
listening to
chamber.
Mr. Grant, the member serves in his own assembly chamber.